The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
It's a beautiful thing to go on a month-long retreat. Not very many people have that opportunity. It's a precious opportunity. Some people get it once in a lifetime, a chance to do something like this. And it's very different from how people normally live their lives. There's very little social activity. There's no talking. It's a silent retreat. The teachers talk, have interviews, and we give Dharma talks and instructions. But retreatants mostly are spending the day in silence, a whole month not working and not on vacation. It's kind of unusual. It's very unusual. So it's very different from how we normally live. And that's part of the value of it, is that we live in a way that's so different than how we normally are living that we get to see ourselves in different ways. We see ourselves, see that maybe perhaps some of the ways in which we live and think can be questioned or looked at in more deeper ways. Or there's an opportunity to look at ourselves unburdened or not clouded by the usual concerns that we have going about. It's quite phenomenal. It's also one of the places in Buddhist practice where we cultivate deeper insight. And the insight that retreats sometimes allow for a kind of deeper insight and understanding of the Dharma or our life than we can reading a Dharma book or hearing a Dharma talk or just kind of living a normal life. Both are valuable areas of practice. But one of the key things that retreats allows is a deeper perception of impermanence. And so this is what I want to talk about a little bit today. And it's a little bit of a paradox or irony or something, that the more still people become, the more acutely they can be aware of impermanence. I mean, you go up to Spirit Rock for a month and you don't do much. Not much changes in terms of, you know, you don't watch television news and get the new book and find out the latest this and that. And you just sit and walk and sit and walk. And every once in a while you have a meal and you go to sleep and you get up and you do sitting meditation and walking meditation. And, you know, it's not a lot goes on, supposedly, on the outside. As people get more still, there's this wonderful reversal that goes on. The more agitated a mind is, the busier or more active the mind is, the more it tends to succumb to the delusion of permanence. The stiller the mind is, so the less movement there is in the mind. The less movement there is in the mind, the more the mind can see how much movement there is in this world. So agitated mind tends to err on the side of seeing permanence. A still mind tends to see impermanence. Because if your mind is still, you see how everything else is always moving. But if your mind is moving faster than everything else can seem pretty still. So one of the functions of deeper vipassana practice is to help overcome a certain distortion. The Buddhist terminology for this is a technical word is upside down thinking. But we can say distortion in English. A distorted way of seeing our life. And there are a variety of distortions that the mind tends to create. And one of them is the distortion of permanence, attributing permanence to things which are not really that permanent. The other is attributing self to those things which are not really ourselves. And the third is attributing happiness to those things which are not really that, you know, ultimately happy. But the primary one is the impermanent one. Now, everyone can see impermanence, and most religions emphasize the value of the insight into impermanence. And in fact, people who really take in some way or other, the impermanence of ordinary life can sometimes be a lot wiser than some Buddhists who haven't. I've met a lot of wonderfully wise people, profound people, for whom the experience of impermanence in life has really opened their hearts, has really showed them something very important. There's a Sufi story of a man who goes to a Sufi teacher and says, I have this ring, and can you inscribe something, some great spiritual wisdom on the ring? So whenever I look at my ring, I can be reminded of this important piece of information. And the Sufi master says, great. He takes the ring and gets it inscribed and gives it back to the man. And the man looks in the ring. And on the ring, it says, this too will pass. This too will pass. Because of the earthquake in Chile and a little while ago in Haiti, it reminds me of how fluid our earth is. We have this distortion. We think it's pretty solid. And all you have to do is go down to the beach in San Mateo and see the sandstone layers are not horizontal but vertical, to realize that the earth shifts a lot, often. And there were some people who were on retreat many years ago in Yucca Valley, where there was an earthquake down there. And they were quite surprised to be doing walking meditation on the desert floor and see the desert floor, buckle and wave, something that's so solid. But, the impermanence, we don't know when dramatic impermanence is going to hit us. Earthquake, death, illness, old age, all kinds of things will come. And sometimes people are taken by surprise for it. In traditional Buddhist countries like Thailand, it seems that people take these kind of surprises much more lightly than they do in other cultures I've encountered, because they expect them. And they often will say, oh, what do you expect? Of course, impermanence. The tire of my car went flat. Of course, impermanence, as opposed to, oh no, this shouldn't be happening. And so, thinking about these recent earthquakes and, what a big impact it has on people's lives, and how hopefully the world gathers around, supports each other, supports those people who've been struck by these tragedies. And I think it's important, especially for us, to think of that way, because one of these years, it's going to be us. One of these years, we're going to be the recipient of the world's generosity and support. Those of us who live here on top of the San Andreas Fault, it'll come, right? And what then? So to see this and to see that impermanence and change is part of life, and to learn to be wise about that, to set up our lives so that we kind of expect it, we know what happens, we try to protect ourselves from the bad effects of it all, but we can't do, No one can guarantee that they can protect themselves from impermanence, for change. And so how do we live our lives in a wise way, in a way that maybe is free, compassionate, in the world of this kind of dramatic change that can happen? I think that's the task of Buddhist practice. One of the tasks is how to be free, how to be generous and compassionate, given the world of sickness, old age, death, impermanence, and change. It's not all bad news, of course, the world of impermanence. Some of us can't wait for things to be changed. The present moment is the drag. and so it is not, sometimes, can't wait for things to change, because then something better can happen. See it with my kids. They can't wait sometimes. One of the refrains of my 7-year-old is, I am bored. I've heard that more times in the last year than in my whole life before it. No. I am bored. And I tell him, well, that's interesting. Or I tell him, well, what do you want me to do about that? Those answers don't get favorable responses in my household. Looking for change, something new. Some people are addicted to change. So it's to be seen in our life all over. Vipassana practice, mindfulness practice, certainly helps us to be present for that and be wise about that and see our reactions and responses, and so they can have wiser reactions and responses. But Vipassana practice, as it gets deeper, as we get more concentrated in our meditation, especially on retreat, there's a whole new opportunity that opens up. And that is not to see impermanence at the large scale of our life, but to start seeing it at the small scale, the minutia scale of our life. And it isn't that the small scale is insignificant. The small scale is the building blocks for the big scale. So just like, you know, cells are the building blocks for a human being. If you understand something about cellular biology, you'll understand something about human being that you don't if you don't understand. So if you can understand something about impermanence in the smaller scale, it becomes a building block for understanding something about the larger world we live in. And so as the mind gets stiller on retreat, at some point, for some people, the more subtle movements of change that happen all the time become more and more evident. In order for that to happen, it requires a change of orientation. And hopefully, when people go on retreat, they're willing to change the orientation about what they're focusing on. Human minds are almost always focusing on something. And there's always the particulars of the moment. There's also background orientation, how we hold everything, the context in which we relate to the world. And so, for example, one of the contexts is we understand it from the point of view of self, me, myself, and mine, how it is for me. Or, especially in the individualistic West, we're very deeply acculturated to see the world as individuals, individualistically. And, you know, it's so deeply ingrained that we just, many Westerners just take it for granted that this is how the universe is built up of individuals. But it's a particular construct to see the world that way. And other cultures, as I think many of you know, maybe some of you come from those cultures, they're not individualistic cultures, but they're communal cultures, where how people are as a community is much more important than how they are as individuals. And recently I read a study, or a report about a study, about how when people from individualistic cultures look at a picture, it's different. They see the picture differently than people who come from a communal culture. And apparently, the individualistic culture, they look at the picture, same picture, right? They look at the picture and they pick out the details. A communal culture tends to pick out the gestalt, or the foreground and background of what's going on. They see the patterns much more. So it has a lot to do with how people are acculturated. And the acculturation has to do with the orientation. So I say that because when people go on retreat, it helps if you're willing to suspend the normal orientation that you have and be willing to kind of try to see something in a new way. And that's not an easy thing to do, but it's part of the challenge of being on a retreat. It's wonderful. I think, you know, retreats are quite wonderful because they provide this wonderful balance, hopefully just the right balance, of being nurturing and safe and comforting and being challenging. If your religion doesn't challenge you, find another religion. If your religion doesn't nurture you, find another religion. But hopefully it does both. When I was ordained as a Zen priest many years ago, I wasn't oriented towards rituals and all that, but I was kind of surprised at that ritual, how much it affected me. And the feeling I had was that when I was ordained as a Zen priest, I had now become a child of the Buddha, kind of poetic way of talking, which meant that all my shortcomings were more acceptable. But on the other hand, I became much more acutely aware of my shortcomings. And that combination, I think, was very meaningful for me, because I didn't get upset or depressed about my shortcomings. It was kind of like I'd been accepted by the Buddha. And I was more acutely aware of them so I could address them. I didn't accept them just to like continue, you know, being grumpy and angry and things like that. Or to say it in a different way that it's often said at the San Francisco Zen Center, it said, "You're perfect, just the way you are." and there's room for improvement. So to hold both, so be on retreat, and to feel the sense that you're being held by the Dharma, by life, by the truth, by the sense that you are perfect as you are, really. And being challenged at the same time, being challenged or being willing to suspend usual orientations we have. And one of the, so the orientation of kind of planning the future, trying to fix and manipulate and plan the future of my life, or the orientation of reviewing all the wrongs that happened to me in the past and kind of reviewing them and being grumpy about them and all that. So those might be valid, those approaches sometimes, but on retreat, really put those aside. Certain identities we have, we carry with us, they're very deeply held. We try to put aside on retreat. Roles that we carried much of our life. Not to orient ourselves towards that. And putting all those things stuff aside for the time being and orienting ourselves to being fully here for the direct experience moment by moment. And as we enter into the direct moment of experience, that's where this world of impermanence begins showing itself. If you're orienting things towards roles, roles can give a semblance of permanence. If you're orienting towards the past, it can orient, I was a victim back 10, 20 years ago. And so now, if I always relate to myself as that victim, you know, it gives a semblance of permanence. Or if we always have an image of ourselves in the future, or what I'm going to become, it can also kind of support the idea of permanence. So how to step back out of that and enter into the direct world is part of the challenge of being on retreat. As people do that, the present moment experience slowly begins to become highlighted and seen more clearly for what it is. So I want to give you some examples of this. So you might start noticing something about your thinking on retreat. You might notice, for example, how repetitive it can be. But you also might notice that it's that particular thoughts that you have, thought trains, are not permanent. They get interrupted. Sometimes they're more permanent on retreats than outside because you don't get interrupted by reality enough. But so you kind of get stuck on certain trains of thought for a while. But you can see that a thought arises, it's there for a while, and then it goes away. And then another thought might arise, and it goes away. Some thought concerns, change of associated thinking continue for a while, but then they change. Sometimes we get stuck in one for many hours, one particular chain of thought, but then it changes. And one of the great lessons on retreat is how much things change over the course of the retreat. And I've been on retreat where I've succumbed to the delusion of permanence, where the first day of the retreat, I felt really delighted to be there and relaxing, and this is perfect. I'm on my way to Buddhahood. I'll always be relaxed. I'll never be depressed again. This is great. And that lasted until the second day. And then I had this splitting headache. I couldn't believe I was on retreat, and who are these people around me who are bumbling around? And this is just, the retreats must be awful, and this is just going to be torture the rest of the time, and probably I should leave because it's not going to change. And then, but luckily I stayed for the third day, and then it's just blissful. I can't believe the sun came out. It's bright and clear. I feel so relaxed and open, and isn't this great? And everyone should go on retreat. I think I'm going to write a letter to everyone and emails and let them know, because this is just like. And then the fourth day comes, and then my great, unresolved issue pops up. And oh no, I thought I put that aside. And, oh no, I'll never get over this issue. I'm always stuck in this issue. It's always there. But then the fifth day happens, right? And so, this tremendous, I've seen, this kind of attachment or identification with the issue at the moment. And we don't think it's permanent, but we act as if the mind acts or believes or behaves as if it's permanent. If you do enough retreats or do a long enough retreat, you start noticing the cycles. So if you go on retreats many times, you start seeing, oh, the first day of the retreat, I'm often tired. Oh, it's just the tiredness of the first day. Don't need to make any conclusions about this. Or, you know, the second or third day, it's often I feel very relaxed. No need to make any conclusions or implications. Just let it be a relaxed day, because that'll change. Something else will happen. And with time, people begin holding all these changes more lightly. And that's a very important understanding. It's not so much about having the right change and organizing the right change to happen. It's learning how to hold the changes that happen more lightly. And that's where a lot of the ease and the freedom occurs, and how we relate to it, not, you know, what's happening. So as we begin kind of allowing, you know, things to happen more and more themselves, we see that thoughts themselves arise and pass. And so one of the great questions is, to preface it this way, people's primary way of understanding who they are, their sense of identity, comes from their thinking, their conceiving, their ideas. And so I might have a thought that arises, I'm a parent. And then, you know, if I'm making dinner for my kids, being a parent role, that's appropriate. But then if I'm with my wife, I don't want to be the parent. I'm supposed to be the husband. That's a different role. But, when I come here to IMC, I'm not supposed to be the parent or the husband. I'm supposed to be the teacher. That's the role. But if I go home and try to be the teacher at home, that's not good. So I have to understand the role that I'm in. But roles have a very powerful, can have a very powerful, where sometimes it's like the actor or actress who eventually believes the role and becomes the role. So we sometimes become the role. But that role, becoming a role, having an identity, is only understood by having a thought that tells us we are that way. We tell ourselves a story. It can be very subtle. It can be below the normal discursive level of thinking. But still, there's a thought. I'm a father, I'm a husband, I'm a teacher, or whatever. What happens when you see a thought arise and you see it pass away? You see the thought of I'm a role, I'm this kind of person, and you see it pass away. Who are you in the space of time where it's passed away and no new thought has arisen? Who are you then? If you don't have a story to tell you who you are, who are you? You're still alive and present and feeling vital and clear, perhaps. But if you're not telling yourself who are you? It's kind of hard to make any conclusions then, isn't it? But you're still something. You're alive and hopefully safe. Because probably if you feel unsafe, you have to use your thinking to tell yourself you're unsafe. So if you see the arising and passing of these thoughts, it begins shifting our relationship to thinking itself. It's very hard to do that in ordinary life, where thinking happens so quickly and so fast. We don't see the arising and passing. And it happens so fast that it gives the kind of sense of illusion of permanence, in the same way that a movie film gives a sense of continuity on the screen. But what we know is that it's really what it is a lot of individual, distinct pictures being shown on the screen. There's no movement happening at all. It seems continuous, but it's not. So the same thing with the mind. So we start seeing something deeper than we can in ordinary life. Why? Why shift this? One of the reasons is so we can see more deeply the building blocks of how we build up the more complicated ideas of who we are in our life. So then we go. So, you know, you can see that with roles, with identities, with thoughts that they arise and pass. And we don't have to pick them up. We can hold those lightly. We don't have to get involved with them at all. Then it can go more deeply. And we can see the arising and passing of emotional states. Sometimes they tend to have longer kind of time that they arise and pass in, sometimes. But sometimes they can be very fast. They can rise and pass very quickly. And in fact, there's probably if you're quiet and sensitive, you can get a sense that there's actually maybe a larger mood that's present, but there's also a kaleidoscope of different little moods that pass through all the time. It's not as solid as it often seems. In ordinary life, where we're living kind of a busy life, or whatever life we're living, there are certain emotional states that can seem kind of permanent or seem kind of like they're really solid. On retreat, when the mindfulness gets strong, the solidity of emotional states begins to break up as well. So like outside of retreat, depression can be it. I was depressed once and I thought, this is it. And I succumbed to the delusion of permanence. I'll always be depressed. Or I remember once, actually, the most depressed time I got in my life was right after a summer that was the most ecstatic summer of my life. And then I said to myself at the end of the summer, I'll never be depressed again. And then I was more depressed than I'd ever been. So I succumbed to the delusion of permanence. But when you're very attentive and present, you see that emotional states as well arise and pass. And they actually arise and pass much faster than you would realize or think if you're thinking about them. Because thinking is one part of how we attribute permanence to things. So I think a fun place where I've kind of seen the kaleidoscope of changing subtle emotions is in driving. Some of you have heard me say this. I'm driving along, and I try to stay present and relaxed and noticing what's going on, and I tune into my emotional states. And I might have a background kind of larger mood, but then I notice a police car pulls up behind me in the freeway, and I feel some fear, apprehension. You know, just kind of like my stomach tightens a little bit. But then police car leaves. And then somebody tries to cut me off, or does cut me off a little bit, and I feel the anger surge up. And then that passes. And then I see this really beautiful, you know, car. And then desire arises for a moment. And then someone's driving really slow in front of me, and the irritation arises. And then you can get the idea, right? And so I find it's kind of fun to watch all this subtle shifting, changing things going on. And my assumption has been that those shifting, subtle changes are happening all the time, even when I'm not paying attention to it. And part of the reason why people get stressed out, build up stress over the course of the day, is because all these things linger. They leave traces in us if we're not wise about how we see them and hold them. So being mindful and present and watching all the reactions, it's easier just to let them go, hold them lightly, and just kind of not have them linger in some way. So we see the arising of an emotion and the passing away. Who are you? After an emotion has passed away and before the next one has arisen, in that space between it, you're still alive, you're present, comfortable, hopefully. Who are you? And then you can go deeper into the body. And one of the more interesting places is with pain. It's not uncommon for people on retreat to have pain. You know, their knees hurt or something, back hurts. And again, we're asked to change our orientation of how we look at our experience. If you look at it through the filter of, this is my pain, poor me, it's going to hurt more. But if you're willing to kind of suspend the attributing me or making an identity around the pain and just see it as pain, and not only see it as pain, but to actually get interested in what is the direct experience of pain, because the word pain is an abstraction. And if we relate to our world through the ideas of abstractions, we won't see it for what it is. And so to drop, go very deeply into the pain and see, oh, it's made up of intense tightening and pulling and searing and stabbing and twisting and, you know, different particular sensations. And then go deeper into it and see that actually the pain that seems so solid when I saw it through concepts and ideas is actually made up of a lot of shifting and changing individual small sensations that arise and pass. And I mean, I've zeroed into pain in my knee, for example. And it just really, in a little square centimeter, is where the pain resides. And then I really try to get into the actual sensation that tells me there's pain there. I see that it's momentary, little kind of sparks that arise and pass. Arise and pass. And then there's a kind of different relationship with the pain, because I'm not seeing it so solid. I see the gaps between it. I see it's not doesn't always stay the same. So who are you in the gap between the rising of a pain and the passing of a pain? What do you identify with? Now, in that gap, the pain arises and it passes. It passes, and before it arises again, are you lingering in your thoughts about the pain? Oh, this pain is so bad, I can't stand it. Poor Gil, he's having such a hard time, this pain, I can't stand it. Not noticing that there was a gap in the pain? Complaining about when the pain wasn't there? What a waste of time. I mean, if you're going to complain, you complain about things which are present. And so it's arising. But then, if it arises, then you can complain, right? But if it arises and it passes so quickly, you can't get the complaining out fast enough. What do you do then? Well, if you're deeply attached to being a complainer, then, you know, you'll figure out some way to keep complaining. But it doesn't make sense to complain about something which arises and passes kind of quickly. It's going to start holding it more lightly. Remember, the point is to hold things lightly. So I'm hoping you get a sense that as mindfulness can really start getting into the direct experience more and more, and questioning or looking at what goes on, we see the subtle kind of micro movements of our experience, how it arises and passes, and begin shifting our relationship to it. It challenges us also. It challenges us not to linger and hold on to the old ideas of self and experience of life that interpret our experience in a particular way. And this is very important, because it's very hard in ordinary states of mind to dislodge or to question some of the deeper attachments, roles, identities that we live by. And we often need some strong medicine to do that. And Buddha, and there's many medicines a person can use for that, but one of the medicines we have in Buddhism is this deep, strong insight meditation practice, where we start seeing much more of the details of what goes on here and now. So as we start seeing things arise and pass more, that's the nature of it, it eventually dawns on the mind that it doesn't make so much sense to cling, to grasp onto, or to resist something which is arising and passing. If something is really going to be permanent, maybe it makes sense. But if you see it arise and pass, so if you see a thought arise, and then see it pass, perhaps there's less inclination to latch onto that thought. So I might be sitting, minding my own business, and the thought arises, I am a really poor meditator. Well, I'm a meditation teacher, so that's serious. And all of you kind of probably assume I'm a good meditator, and you know, this is important, I'm a role model and everything. And so, you know, so as soon as I have that thought, it's like, you know, I latch onto it, this is terrible, how am I going to hide it from everyone? I certainly don't want to announce it to everyone, you know. And I get caught up in this world, you know, I get to that idea. And I kind of spend the next, you know, 2 days depressed around that thought. Or a thought arises, I'm a bad meditator. I see it arise, and I see it pass. And I don't do anything about it. I don't latch onto it. If I see it arise and pass quick enough, if I know it's going to pass in a moment, why would I even want to pick it up? Let it go. So as we see things arise and pass more carefully, then mind tends not to want to latch on, because it doesn't make sense to latch on. And one of the reasons why this very deep insight practice is so useful is that when the mind clearly sees it doesn't make any sense to grasp onto things, it begins to relax and relax and relax, until finally the mind is relaxed enough it can be equanimous about all the comings and goings, this experience of our life. It's not trying to create a self out of it, it's not trying to hold on to it in a particular way, it's not attributing permanence or impermanence, it's not attributing anything to it, it's not attributing suffering to it or happiness to it, is not attributing safety or lack of safety to it. It just kind of, it allows things just to be. It allows our experience just to be it as it is. And that very deep sense of equanimity is kind of the cream of holding things lightly. Equanimity doesn't mean we're indifferent to things, to experience, but it just kind of almost like, I think of it as a form of generosity, where we can we're generous enough to leave things alone so they can be what they are. We're generous enough to leave ourselves alone so we can be as we are. The thoughts, the feelings, whatever it is, we have the equanimity, it's okay this way. You're perfect just the way you are. And it's okay. It's okay to improve yourself. It's okay to let someone know that you're kind of unusual and that you're working on it. It's okay. You know, so it's equanimity. And when the equanimity is strong enough, when they're established enough, is still enough, that's when the mind has the greatest opportunity to let go the best, or relax the best, or kind of just chill out the best. And I say it this way, you've probably noticed that I've used these kinds of expressions, the mind learns not to cling, the mind relaxes in a deep way, as opposed to you. You chill out finally. You let go finally. Because the deeper kind of deeper possibilities of freedom and of compassion is not something that you do. It's not something that you can really, it doesn't make sense even to identify with it. This is my doing, my thing. It's an activity of the mind or the heart that it naturally will, when it's ready and when time is there, it will, when you have enough equanimity, when the equanimity has become so ordinary that it's as ordinary as brushing your teeth, then sometime the mind gets the lesson, the mind hears, and then lets go in a deep way. So there's impermanence at the macro level. You see impermanence of the micro level, which is kind of the specialty of Vipassana practice, deep practice to see. And then there's the impermanence of letting something go. And when something is let go deeply enough and it's no longer there, that is permanent. The absence of something, you know, when something is absent, it's not a thing. Only things arise and pass. The absence of things, they don't rise and pass because it's absent, right? And so the absence of clinging and the absence of certain ways of understanding, you know, is seen through or dropped. And that can stay and be there as an understanding or as a way of being for much longer time. So I hope that the world of impermanence is kind to you. And if it isn't, I hope you're kind to it. Thank you very much.